from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight, we're diving into the life of gypsy jazz guitar legend Django Reinhardt. Django, as everyone knew him, was a boundary crosser, a creative genius, playing relief and beauty in a time of war and turmoil. Here's a recording of his wartime classic, Nuage. The son of a traveling entertainer, Jean Reinhardt, was known to the world by his gypsy name Django, meaning I awake. He grew up in a gypsy camp outside Paris, performing as a young boy in the city's wild dance halls. A caravan fire mutilated his left hand when he was 18, forcing him to create a unique fingering technique using only his index and middle fingers. In spite of his handicap, he would become one of the greatest guitarists the world has ever known, rolling out hits in the Great Depression, in Nazi-occupied World War II France, touring in America with Duke Ellington. Django was a sensation in a world looking for distraction and relief. Now, over 50 years after his death, the music of Django Reinhardt and his hauntingly romantic chords linger on, capturing the imagination of jazz aficionados and novices alike. Tonight on Point, the life and music of legendary jazz guitarist Django Reinhardt. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine the clubs of the 1920s Paris, where a young gypsy genius met the magic of American jazz? Do you hear the gift of the outcast's art in the music of the gypsy guitarist Django? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from St. Paul, Minnesota, is Michael Dregney, columnist, reviewer, and feature writer for Vintage Guitar Magazine. He is author of the new biography, Django, The Life and Music of a Gypsy Legend. Michael Dregney, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Tom. Pleased to be here.
And what a fully detailed story you tell. You take us way into the fascinating fabric of Django Reinhardt's life. My hat's off to you. It's really a terrific biography. I enjoyed it enormously.
Well, thank you.
You know, I'm mindful as we jump into the life and music of Django Reinhardt that we will have people who know him up and down and have shelves full of his music and others who won't know a thing about him. How do you introduce Django Reinhardt, who you know so intimately and well, to someone who just doesn't know anything about him, Michael?
Well, I think people are fascinated by his gypsy background. I mean, we tend to have romantic notions about gypsy life and so on, but I think the element of his gypsy background comes through in his jazz, and I think that's what really fascinates people.
And we'll get to that. I want to hear a lot about it. It is fascinating. And what about Django Reinhardt as a musician? How do you describe his place in 20th century music?
Well, he was really the first solo guitarist. Before that, a guitar or a banjo was used primarily as a rhythm instrument. It was used basically to make woo. And Django, along with a couple others like Eddie Lang in the United States, first used a guitar as a solo instrument, playing single string, single note solos that mimicked violin lines, mimicked saxophone lines, and so on. And he really created the guitar as an instrument and became so influential. I mean, most any guitarist today has heard of him, has listened to his music, has some influence from Django.
Michael Dregney, I want to go back and look at that gypsy culture and upbringing. But it might be informative to look kind of at the, I don't know, maybe the peak of Django Reinhardt's career. Certainly a great time for him. You describe him in 1937, the beginning of 1937, as the toast of Paris. And I wish you'd paint that picture in of Paris at Django Reinhardt's peak and his place in it?
Oh, at the time, you had the sort of the turmoil in the world of you know, people had the sense that there was going to be another war with Nazi Germany kind of breathing down their necks. And, you know, they had gone through World War I and described it as the war to end all wars. So there was this kind of vague dread in the air, even that early. I think in the United States, probably people didn't feel it, but in Europe, they certainly did. And kind of as an escape from that, there was people were throwing themselves into music, into the culture in Paris, and you had new classical music, Stravinsky and so on, were still being digested. You had writing like Joyce's Ulysses in Paris that came out in 1922, but still that was influencing writing. You had the arts there. It was just a great time in Paris.
You're talking Lennon and Hemingway and Josephine Baker and Picasso and, as you write, Expressionists, Cubists and Dadaists and an amazing ferment alongside that between the wars and now approaching World War II sense of dread. And within that, here's this gypsy who traditionally would have been a real outsider, even outcast in Europe, and as you say, is the toast of Paris, the Rothschilds pairing him to perform at their soirees and movie stars dancing to his music. You quote a countess saying, "This gypsy is worth a Goya." Give us a sense of what it meant to be the toast of Paris in 1937.
Well, as you say, he was an outcast up until that point, and he was a pariah. And on stage, when he was playing this beautiful music, you know, he was the toast. But as soon as he was off stage, again, he was the gypsy that they were afraid would steal their cutlery. But I think for him, he kind of led this schizophrenic life. He grew up in a caravan, so poor that he couldn't afford his first banjo. And all of a sudden, he was thrown into the limelight. He was making money as fast as he could pick his guitar. And I think it was just beyond anything he could imagine.
And this, a boy who had grown up picking that guitar with anything he could get his hands on in his poverty, you say, the tip of a spoon, a sewing thimble of his mother's, a two-sou piece, a bit of whalebone that was a shirt collar stiffener were Django Reinhardt's guitar picks.
Exactly. I mean, as I say, he couldn't afford his first banjo. It was given to him by a friend. And, you know, this instrument became just everything to him. He slept with it. He played it all day long. He probably attended school for maybe a dozen days in his life, but he would spend his days playing this banjo, often accompanied by his brother, Joseph Reinhardt, and they would travel around Paris and play in the flea markets, in the cafes, trying to earn some money.
We want to hear all about that, but before we go back to his youth, let's just get a moment of that toast of Paris time of Django Reinhardt. 1937 here, Django Reinhardt with Minor Swing, classic early Django, and his friend Stefan Grappelli, who you can't pull away from Django Reinhardt's story, right in here, one of his most famous compositions. Let's listen, Minor Swing. Django Reinhardt, 1937, Minor Swing, there along with the song we heard at the top of the hour, Nuage, one of the best-selling compositions in the pre-war age. Michael Dragne, I wish you'd take what we're hearing right there apart for us a little bit, both musically and, I don't know, in terms of emotion or mood. What was it that this toast of Paris was delivering mood-wise that Parisians so ate up in 1937?
Well, jazz was just a revolution. You know, people were used to waltzes, were used to marching music, were used to classical music, and then along comes jazz, and it's like musical anarchy. It's alive and it has energy and it's fun, and then you can just dance to it with abandon. And Django's, he's playing, he had been inspired by Louis Armstrong to play jazz, and he plays it on guitar with Grappelli on violin. And it's just, I mean, you hear it, it's just happy, lively, fun music. And here he is playing all those dashing chromatic runs and arpeggios and octaves, playing them with basically just two fingers, fretting those, just, you know, in the movie clips of him that exist, just lightning speed, his hands and his fingers dashing up and down the fretboard.
And did this sound avant-garde to Parisians in 1937, or was this standard dance hall music by that time?
I think there's it was a bit of both. In the early days, he was playing this jazz in restaurants for dancers. And it was kind of, there was probably an element of sort of a dirtiness to the music that was probably intriguing, that this was, you know, as people said at the time, this was the music of savages. And that was part of the draw of it, the allure of it.
Did it sound exotic to them? Would they listen and hear something that sounded like gypsy music?
I think it probably sounded like nothing they had ever heard before. It was jazz. It was American, which was certainly a fascination. But the gypsiness, I think it's always difficult to tell exactly where the gypsy side of Django begins and end. Once he heard jazz, he never really recorded much gypsy music, straight-ahead gypsy music. But you can hear the gypsiness in his jazz playing, in the virtuosity, which the gypsies loved, in the choice of the minor chords with the kind of darkness and mysteriousness, use of sixth notes, ninth notes, seventh notes, thirteenths, diminished chords, and so on, that all added this mood of mystery to it.
Mood of mystery and a playing style that had a lot to credit to flamenco guitar.
I think that's very true. It's not only in the technical way that he held his hands in playing the guitar, but the sound of it has kind of a flamenco sound translated into jazz.
We're going to hear a lot more about the really incredible youth and career of Django Reinhardt, but I keep thinking about this man between the wars and this uncertain time, and especially we'll talk about occupied Paris as well, but approaching World War II, this sense of vague dread. And in the face of that, Michael Dregney, an artist who kept making this music that, as you say, made people, it had this exotic, erotic edge, but it made people happy almost in the face of that dread.
I think that's true. I mean, many of the melodies that he wrote, to me, they sound like the happiest songs ever written. I mean, they have this beautiful happiness, joyousness to them.
It makes me wonder exactly what we've got to learn from an artist, an outsider, an artist like Django Reinhardt in the uncertain and sometimes dread-filled corners of the time we live in right now. We'll talk about that. My guest tonight is Michael Dregney. He's author of a terrific new biography of Django Reinhardt. It's called Django, The Life and Music of a Gypsy Legend. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you hear in the music of the gypsy genius who took 1930s Paris by storm? And what is the gift of the outsider to music and to art? Why this sound in the years between the wars, from the years of war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're talking about the life and music of gypsy jazz legend Django Reinhardt. Here from 1941 is Swing 42, written in the midst of World War II when Django was at the peak of his popularity. Guest tonight is Michael Dregney. His new biography of Django Reinhardt is Django, the Life and Music of a Gypsy Legend. You can join the conversation tonight. Are Django and Stefan Grappelli part of the soundtrack of your life, your grandparents' lives? And do you hear solace in this music for hard, uncertain, dread-filled times? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Dregney, we're going to come back and talk about these early 40s when Django Reinhardt was still a sensation in Nazi-occupied Paris. Quite a picture. But I really want to get the story of his origin and of the gypsy background here. You describe him born into a genuine, old-fashioned gypsy caravan in 1909. What was the life that his family lived then?
Well, his family traveled. They lived in this caravan. They traveled from Paris to the Netherlands, south through the Midi of France to Italy in a pattern that followed the seasons. And Django was born just as 1910 dawned in Belgium on a cold winter's night into this caravan that basically was a box on wheels, and it measured about 7 feet wide by 14 feet long by 6 feet high. And within this caravan lived Django's father, his mother, who was a dancer and performed with the father in his musical troupe, and two other children from a previous marriage. And this family lived in this box and traveled around selling jewelry, performing in towns for money, just basically doing anything they could to survive.
Remind us of the origins of Europe's gypsies, and which is a rich story in itself, and then something of how they were perceived, received, treated in Europe a century ago. But the origins, well, you'll tell us.
Well, I think it's a tough question, and by analyzing the Romani language, it bears lots of similarities to Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. And so people have traced the Romani back to India, and they were originally conscripted from lower caste groups into an army to fight invading Muslim armies. And
we're talking after, 1,000 years ago, maybe.
Oh, yes, 1,000 mm-hmm. years ago. Mm-hmm. And after roughly a decade of wars through Persia and into the Middle East, the gypsies, some of them returned back to India. Others traveled on, splitting apart, following what became known as the Romani Trail in through Eastern Europe, up to Germany and France. Others continued through North Africa, crossing at Gibraltar into Spain and into Europe from that way.
Europeans, you write, believing that these dark-skinned wanderers came from Egypt, a corrupted Egyptian into gypsy, or Romani, as they might call themselves.
Yes, there's many different myths about this and stories, and I think it's very difficult to separate fact from fiction, from myth. But One story is that the gypsies told people they were from Egypt. They were princes traveling from Egypt and do lots of honor and so on. And the term became translated into gypsy.
But there was myth, but there were also very hard facts on the ground. Louis XIV, 1682, telling his sheriffs to round up gypsy men as slaves, gypsy women flogged and banished, deported, just sent right out of Europe. You write to North Africa, Gambia, Senegal, to Louisiana in the New World.
It's right, and it's a sad story. You know, gypsies were enslaved all through Europe, through North Africa, and spent centuries basically fighting to be free of this. They were largely kept on the move. I mean, we have this romantic image of the wandering gypsy looking to the horizon, but I think they largely kept on the move because they were basically on the run.
You described Django Reinhardt as a youth, as a proficient robber of chickens, somebody who knew how to sneak up very quietly, grab that farmer's chicken and vanish, and that this was prized in his community.
It really was. I mean, to survive, they had to live on the road. They had to live by their wits. And if that was stealing a chicken, stealing a duck, stealing a goat, fishing illegally, you know, that's what they did to survive, and they took a pride in being able to live that way.
So this boy was living the gypsy life. His father ultimately took off. He settled with his mother on the outskirts of Paris, which were not the Belle Epoque Paris, that beautiful, glittering Paris, but the zone around, still a zone today, of poverty, then on the ramparts of old Paris. How did he, I mean, music was just in the air, but how did Django Reinhardt emerge as an exceptional musician within his own community first?
Well, he learned to play first violin, following his father and some uncles, learning to play around the gypsy campfires as they traveled. And there's a style of the gypsies teaching their children to play, patiently showing them the fingering, playing the melody over and over as they learned. And Django learned this way. He learned by watching other people play and mimicked these songs that he heard. And there was a vast mix of different types of music, Eastern European melodies, flamenco melodies, playing the classical music, sort of the popular music of the day. And all of this kind of is a real melting pot of music, sort of sifted through this gypsy sensibility. And Django took this and he just lived it.
He took it some incredible places. Let's just get a feeling for that here from 1943, Castle of My Dreams, Django Reinhardt. Django Reinhardt, 1943, Castle of My Dreams. There is a beauty. We're joined tonight by Michael Dregney. He's authored the new biography, Django, The Life and Music of a Gypsy Legend. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jim is calling from Denver, Colorado. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. It's very interesting to listen to your show tonight.
Great to have you. What's on your mind, Jim?
Well, the reason I called in, about a month ago, I picked up a... I don't know if you're familiar with it. At Starbucks, you can buy those CDs.
Sure. Who hasn't seen them? Sure.
Yeah, you know, where artists have their favorites and the people who influenced them.
Right. Oh yeah, the collections of music that influenced their own work. That's right, sure.
That's right. And Willie Nelson. I picked up a Willie Nelson CD, and Reinhardt's on that.
Well, and can't you hear that right now in the guitar on this track?
Willie Nelson playing the guitar.
It really does. I'm so glad you reminded us of that, Jim. Michael Dregney, I must say, it's right here in our ears. It almost does sound like a tribute to Django, to Willie Nelson, except in reverse here.
Oh, Willie Nelson is a great fan of Django. I mean, just a huge fan. And, you know, I think that's, as we were saying, I mean, Django was just, he made guitar what it is. And his influence just went in all directions. I mean, the jazz is obvious. But Chet Atkins was a huge fan of Django's and saw him when he came to the United States. And, you know, there's the perfect trail to Willie Nelson. B.B. King was a huge fan. And from B.B. King, you get to Jimi Hendrix. And, even people like Hector Malvacino, who was the guitarist with Astor Piazzolla's Tango Group, was a huge fan and recorded covers of Django's music. So he just is everywhere in guitar.
Jim, thanks for calling us with that. Michael Dregney, I love the picture you paint of the clubs dance halls in Paris where a very young Django Reinhardt was playing. The gas lamps, sometimes the neon lights, as you say, City of Lights, it was in part about electricity, and these dance halls glowing like a promised land. The men shaken down for brass knuckles and stilettos and pistols as they come in. The furniture nailed to the floor so it couldn't be thrown around. The banquettes, you know, there because they didn't want chairs either. They could be turned into weapons. Drinks never in bottles that could double as weapons. And there's Django Reinhardt and his crew. Very young play.
He was 14 years old when he first entered into this world. He had been playing his banjo, and another gypsy who was an accordionist and had become kind of a star in these dance halls hired him to join his band. And, you know, here was Django's big break, and the first thing he has to do is go ask his mother if he can go out. And it was a rough and tumble world that he entered into. I don't even know if we can imagine it today. Although it sounds like some country western bars, I don't know. But here he was. He's 14 years old. He goes off to play the nights away in these rough dance halls. There were fights. There were knife duels. It was an amazing place to learn to play in the trenches.
And then, of course, within a few years, the tragedy, which he turned in to beauty, but the thing that defined so much of his style, when he would go from the caravan, as you describe it, from the dance hall and back home to his very young wife, who was in the caravan putting together celluloid flowers when Django Reinhardt came home one night, the whole house on wheels, full of these highly flammable celluloid flowers. He thought he heard a mouse rustling under them, lit a candle, and tell us the rest of that story, Michael Durden.
Well, these celluloid, of course, was just horribly flammable, and he came home. He was 18 years old. His wife was about 18 and pregnant. Early in the morning, after a night of playing in the dance halls, and he dropped this candle, and these flowers just burst into flame, and instantly the caravan became an inferno. He helped his wife escape from it. He was trying to put the fire out. He had a blanket over him, and it was suffocating in this small space with these flames and the smoke, and something kept him going and forced him to escape out of this. And the gypsies rounded him up, and they took him across town to the pauper's hospital, where the doctors thought they needed to amputate his leg. He'd never had a chance to use his hands again, and the gypsies were distrustful of this modern medicine, this miracle medicine, and they kind of spirited him away again. And
he kept his leg, but not all his fingers.
Right. The gypsies bathed him in herbs and tried to save him. And ultimately, after 18 months of convalescence, he retrained himself to use just the two fingers on his left hand that he could fret with. And he had sort of minimal use of the other fingers to do some fretting of chords. But by and large, all those long, glorious runs you hear are those two fingers.
It's just an amazing story, and we'll have you tell us how to listen for that in the way he plays, but I want to invite our callers in. Sims is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Sims. You're on the air.
Hey, you guys. It's a wonderful show. Hey, Michael. How you doing?
Hi, Sims.
Hey. I'm a Django fan and player, and actually on my way to a gig.
Oh, great.
The first time we went to Europe, had a band, and we used it to travel around, and we went to Paris and thought, you know, we got to get to this little village somewhere south of Paris to find Django. And it's a little town called Saint-Moi-sur-Seine. It's where he's buried and where he lived the last years of his life.
Yeah.
You guys may have talked about it already.
No, we haven't. Tell us. That was just the last couple of years of his life. And what did you find there?
Well, we kind of wandered through the town, beautiful little town. You've been there a bunch, Michael, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't see anything, and we were looking around, and this old guy walking down the street with a loaf of bread under his arm and a bottle of wine, and we don't speak any French, and we mentioned the name Django Reinhardt, and he just flipped out and took us to his grave and took us to his house, and then we found another English guy who translated, and this guy had played billiards with Django and said he was the best billiards player he'd ever seen, but he was very generous and would let this old guy win every once in a while.
Of course, he died in 1953, so that was a long time back. What was the state of his grave when you visited it, Sims?
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's just beautiful. And every year there's a pilgrimage. A lot of gypsies come. It's around the time of the festival in late June.
And you play Django. Why Django, Sims? I mean, so does Michael Dragne, I guess. Let me ask you why. Yeah. You're about to go out and play.
It just it makes sense. It's the way music is supposed to sound, you know. I'm a mandolin player, and I took lessons with Jethro Burns, who turned me on to Django. And it's just, you know, we're all concerned with the left hand, which note we're playing. But Django's power and his beauty was in his pick and his the overwhelming power, and it's gorgeous. And just like Emmett Ray, you know, if you sit down and listen to it, it'll make you cry over and over again.
It sure will. It sure will. Yeah. Sims, we wish you a terrific gig tonight, and we're so glad you shared the story with us. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks. Keep it up, you guys. It sounds wonderful.
Terrific.
Thanks, Sims.
Thanks for being with us. There it is, Michael. You know the draw of that as well, whether it's Willie Nelson or Sims or yourself. To try and walk this path that Django Reinhardt laid out is what gets a lot of musicians up in the morning, guitarists.
I think it's true. It's an inspiration for guitarists to try to play this music. I mean, here this man is handicapped by only having two fingers, yet the rest of us spend years trying to even pick out the melodies and you know, catching up with him and having those musical ideas that he had. And they're beyond.
And the technique that Sims was talking about, not only with his burnt left hand, but his picking as well?
His picking, he basically played like a flamenco player. His hand wouldn't touch the fretboard. He used a pick, which was different from a flamenco. But most of his playing was in his elbow. You can hear he would move from his elbow, and then at times he'd play these glorious sort of the gypsies called the jangling of keys, and he'd play these vibratos that were just sort of jarring chords.
That's beautiful to hear. Here is 1944. I Can't Give You Anything But Love. Django Reinhardt leading his own big band by that point, La Django's Music. My guest tonight is Michael Dragne. His new biography of Django Reinhardt, Django, The Life and the Music of a Gypsy Legend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life and the music of gypsy jazz guitar legend Django Reinhardt here from 1947, How High the Moon. Django picks it there. My guest tonight, Michael Dragne, author of Django, The Life and Music of a Gypsy Legend. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Heather is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Heather. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Michael. This is just wonderful.
Oh, good.
Two things, a bit off topic.
Yeah.
Django was so important for Europeans in this period before the war.
In what sense? In what sense, Heather?
I have a very fond memory of a friend, George Savides, a great scholar, a Greek, who brought Django to Cambridge in the early 80s.
Yeah.
This was an artist who inspired so many people across Europe. It's wonderful.
And when you say brought him to Cambridge, you mean he just introduced or reintroduced the music there to more people?
He played Django for all of us.
Yeah.
And also, just a personal note, my mother had half her hand blown off in a munitions accident in the war period. Mm-hmm. And for someone to go forward with half a hand, it was really... It's an amazing thing to manage to do.
Inspiring. But, and to make genius, just to demonstrate genius with that.
Thanks to you both.
Hey, thank you, Heather. Thanks for calling. Michael Drigny, I wish you'd describe to us that wartime period and how Django Reinhardt not only survived but thrived. I mean, gypsies were put into Nazi concentration camps, and yet he was in Paris, he was playing, he was... I think still kind of still a toast of the city. How did he make do during the war?
Oh, it's the great irony of his life. Here you had the Nazis, Josef Goebbels, who was proscribing jazz. He wanted to outlaw this modern music, this American music, because it went against everything the Nazis stood for. Yet on the same time, he also understood that this was music that his soldiers loved, that the German people loved, and so while he proscribed it, he still had to allow it. And in Paris, the city was occupied, but the German soldiers were all sent there. They had a program called every soldier one time in Paris, and it was basically the brothel of the German army. And the German soldiers would come to Paris for wine, women, and jazz. And for most of them, jazz meant Django. They knew of him. They wanted to come see him and hear him play.
And even as a gypsy, as the racially proscribed person of Europe, he was exempt.
He was exempt. He was paid to play. The German high command would come to see him play, and he was at a peak of popularity. He was richer than he could have ever believed. He was living in an apartment on the Champs-Élysées. He was eating steaks while other people were eating turnips.
Did he know what was happening to other gypsies? He must have. He never seemed to lose track of that community. How did he feel about that?
I think he must have known, because there were stories of survivors from the prisoners of war camp coming to see him in Paris and saying, I want to see the real Django Reinhardt. I have spent time with the real Django Reinhardt in a prisoner of war camp. And the sad story is that some gypsy who had been rounded up was saying that he was Django Reinhardt to try to save his skin.
He came out of that war, and his star began to wane, but then he had a period of interacting with American jazz legends. How was that for Django Reinhardt and for the Americans?
Oh, for Django, it was his dream come true. You know, he had long dreamed of coming to the United States, the promised land of jazz, and finally in 1946, Duke Ellington invited him to come on a tour that took him from New York to Cleveland, across the Midwest to Minneapolis, into Nebraska, and then back to Boston and along the West Coast, along the East Coast, and finally to two big concerts at Carnegie Hall in New York. And to Django, this was just his great moment. And it's interesting because Django came to the United States and he was playing swing. He was playing what was basically old-fashioned music in the Americans' eyes, while Duke Ellington and his band were playing this modern jazz, verging on bebop.
And off it was to go. You said much earlier that Django played jazz people could dance to. That began to drift away. He dabbled with that, and we'll hear it as we go out. A 1953 recording, Anuma, this is from the very end of his life, showing that influence of Miles Davis. What did you think of the direction that jazz was going as he declined, Michael?
Well, I think he was always searching for something new in jazz, and when he first heard bebop, he embraced it, and tried to learn to speak this new vocabulary of bebop on the guitar. And then when he heard Miles Davis in Paris, probably in 1950-51, he began to play this more simple, minimalistic, and ultimately eloquent music. And gone were these flurries of feverish flamenco-style notes, and in their place was this sort of simple sound that you can hear here in Anuman.
It's been a great tour of a fascinating life in another time of a bit of dread and uncertainty, some decades from our own. Michael Dregney, thanks for the book, and thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
Michael Dregney is author of the new biography, Django, The Life and Music of a Gypsy Legend. This is from 1953, Anuman. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
In recent weeks and months, President Bush and I have talked about foreign policy, and we've talked about what to do at the end of the first term. It has always been my intention that I would serve one term.
I have come to know the men and women of the Department of State. I have the utmost admiration and respect for their skill, their professionalism, and their dedication.
Those who may have gotten away, those who left early, the cowards that they are, that fired this town up and left those behind to die and moved on, those individuals will be pursued.
He's making me sick! He's making me sick!
We should not be providing the Al Jazeera with the kind of propaganda that they've had the last couple, 3 days.
For Margaret, that having endured so much suffering and in her imprisonment and death, that she may know peace and rest in the presence of God. Lord, hear us.
We have a very different relationship than we did during the Cold War, and we are working together to significantly reduce our nuclear arsenals.
It provides Kmart with the scale, the resources, the brands to be even more differentiated versus Walmart and Target in the marketplace and be more successful than they would be without on their own. Obviously, there's a significant amount of scale advantage here as well.
The thing I want most is for people to come to this library, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, liberals or conservatives, to see that public service is noble and important.
And there is a week. Colin Powell resigns as Secretary of State. Condoleezza Rice is nominated to take his place. The commanding general of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, John Sattler, says Fallujah has been liberated from insurgents, though fighting goes on. A Marine is caught on camera apparently shooting a wounded, unarmed man, insurgent, in Fallujah. Aid worker Margaret Hassan is remembered as a tireless humanitarian after a videotape apparently shows her being shot dead by her captors in Iraq. The White House responds cautiously to Russian President Vladimir Putin's assertion that Russia is developing a new type of nuclear weapon. Sears and Kmart merge, creating the nation's third largest retailer. And former President Bill Clinton speaks at the dedication of his library in Little Rock, Arkansas. And there's that voice, Jack, blast from the 90s, Bill Clinton back for his big day, up from heart surgery and in the company of, what was it, three or four presidents there.
Yes, and, you know, just watching him, listening to him speak, he's so wise, so clear, by turns shrewd, witty, and healing. You know, he said, I may be the only person in America who likes both George W. Bush and John Kerry. Mm. And that was so like Bill Clinton, you know, that people, even when he was fighting Gingrich and his avowed enemies, he said, well, these people aren't bad people. We just have different ideas about what's right for the country. And that note of healing, that we can have politics, we can have disagreements, and yet still be united as Americans and not impugn each other's characters. Boy, that is so rare today in politics.
But there were such times, Jack, when Bill Clinton was bitter and when he was impugned and did his own silver-tongued impugning in return.
Yes, but you know, I'd never think he returned the he turned the other cheek, it seems to me, than the opposite, because his whole outlook was, you know, we're going to have a third way in American politics. It's going to be a little conservative, a little progressive. It's going to be, you know, bringing in the best of both traditions, and he got flack from both sides there. His liberals were very unhappy with him, voting against his budget balancing bill, and conservatives, of course. He ignited them to such a degree, I think, that George W. Bush is, in a sense, Bill Clinton's chief heir.
Chief heir. So when you look at that library out over the river there in Little Rock, looking like the uncompleted bridge to the 21st century, the legacy you're describing for Bill Clinton, Jack, is what?
I think is George Bush, and certainly it is a Republican Congress, probably for the rest, I would think, for the rest of our lives, just because of the nature of gerrymandering today and how essentially politicians pick their voters rather than the other way around.
And you're saying Bill Clinton bequeathed that because his third way built a ramp for the Republicans, because his sexual shenanigans, you know, whipped up a backlash. Why?
Well, because the Republicans captured the House the first time in 40 years. That was the historic moment in 1994. And why did they do it? Partly because Bill Clinton did such a poor job of political management in his health care reform proposal. And that was, as I say, that may not be reversed in our lifetime. And then, of course, the Lewinsky and other scandals helped to create this, quote, moral issue, where people feel the Democrats are not moral, Republicans are. And I think a lot of that, and that came back even in this election against John Kerry, and it certainly sunk Al Gore. So, yeah, I'm afraid that uniquely in American history, his legacy, his political legacy, is to the other party.
And what about the third way now, Jack, the way in between Republicans and Democrats? Are Democrats going to stay on that road? Do you think Republicans can imagine taking it, or they don't feel like they have to?
I don't think they're going to take it at all. They don't want to make any gestures toward the middle. They've gotten by with what they have, and there doesn't seem to be any mood toward, well, let's moderate our course. In fact, the opposite. The House GOP just basically suspended its rules so that in case Tom DeLay gets indicted, he can still serve as their leader. So the third way seems to be sort of missing now in American politics, and yet every poll says that's where the voters are.
that's where they are, but where's the politician with them? Do you hear Bill Clinton acknowledging any of this, Jack?
I don't. I mean, I think it's hard for him to do it. I think he must feel some responsibility. He wants to have a bigger legacy and a legacy that isn't so paradoxical. But I think he has to, in the dark of night, he's got to recognize that events that he either didn't stop or set in train himself have resulted in really a Republican grip on the whole government.
Well, a smart guy, how fascinating it would be to crawl inside his brain and see what he's really and truly thinking in there. Jack, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Lauren Madelon and Rachel Dornhelm. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.